Josephine Bonaparte wanted the wombats, kangaroos, black swans and emus for herself to roam the gardens of the Chateau de Malmaison. So Napoleon intervened and they never reached their intended destination, the Paris Zoo, founded in the Revolution, the first modern zoo of Europe. Richard W. Burkhardt Jr., Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois, has just published The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era. Richard, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a delight to be with you.
There have always been zoos, haven't there, where the leaders of Europe, like the Bonapartes, kept their lions and wombats. But the Paris Zoo was different.
The important thing about the Paris Zoo was it was the first metropolitan zoo and the first public zoo. And there had been royal zoos before, but this was a zoo that accidentally came into being during the Revolution, and there was no way that if it were going to be a viable menagerie or zoo, as the word later became known, it had to distance itself entirely from what Louis XIV had built at Versailles. So this had to be a new menagerie. It had to be something that was not sumptuous, something that was presumably for the good of the new republic. That's at least what they claimed and that's what they hoped for.
And instead of it being a privilege for a member of the public to be admitted to the Royal Zoo to see these wild beasts, anyone could.
Anyone could. And that had not happened before. And so the interesting thing about the public was it was not particularly well behaved. We can talk about that.
We will. But first, it was a true revolutionary act. Who decided to bring the animals in from Versailles to Paris, and where did they end up?
It was essentially totally accidental with respect to the Museum of Natural History. It was where it was situated. The Museum of Natural History was new in the spring of 1793, and what became the menagerie happened in the fall of 1793, and it happened when the local police decided that animal exhibitors who were showing their wild and exotic creatures like leopards on the streets of Paris were a danger to the public, and those animals should be confiscated and taken to the Museum of Natural History. So that's in fact how it began. The animals at Versailles didn't come to the museum until the following spring.
And so the title of your book is The Leopard and the Garden. And they were the leopards being shown by sort of private showmen. You paid a few francs or something to get in, or some team to get in and see the wild animal. What was the garden?
Well, the garden was the Jardin des Plantes of Paris. It used to be the garden of the king, and the Jardin des Plantes is a beautiful place where flowers are displayed. It's also a place for collecting various dried specimens of as many plants in the world as one could find. But this was a spot where the public could happily come and take leisurely strolls. And all of a sudden, there's this introduction of live animals, exotic animals, and in fact, dangerous animals. So the leopard in the garden is actually the founding animal almost of this zoo. It was taken from the Place de la Révolution, and it was taken to the Museum of Natural History, essentially dropped at the gates, and it came as a complete surprise to the professors of the museum because they had not asked for it. They didn't particularly want live animals, and they didn't know what to do with them, so they essentially hired the previous proprietors of the animals who had had their animals confiscated, and they made them the animal keepers. But the museum's first interest was just more specimens, and live specimens, particularly animals, weren't as easy to deal with as dead specimens. Zoology at the time was all about dead specimens.
I hadn't thought of that before. A zoo is a kind of botanic garden for animals.
Yes. So, in fact, zoological garden would have been the first word from which our word zoo came. It was an abbreviation of zoological garden.
You hinted before that the public behaved rather badly when they got to see these animals. What happened?
Well, as you can imagine, just about as soon as the animals were put into some enclosures, there were signs that went up, and essentially they said in French, ne jette rien aux animaux, which means either don't feed the animals, don't throw anything to them. It could also be interpreted as don't throw anything at them. And the fact was then that the public, even perhaps like today, didn't really like to see animals that weren't moving around. So if an animal wasn't moving, they would throw stones at the animal. Or they'd send their dogs into an animal's pen to get the animal up and moving. Or they would, soldiers like to rattle their sabers against the bars of the lion's cage. So the public was very badly behaved by our standards. But at that time, any societies for the prevention of cruelty animals were yet to be founded. And,
indeed.
And there are different ideas about what was acceptable behavior. But the museum, of course, thought that was terrible behavior, but they kept trying for the next 50 years to thwart it, and it alas continued.
Richard, when did they decide to begin collecting animals, not just mopping up stray, wild, dangerous animals being paraded on the streets of Paris, but actually collect?
Collecting can take different forms, but there was a broader confiscating than mopping up the animals from the streets of Paris. There was the confiscating of animals along with art treasures and other such things when the French armies went into the Low Countries. So the first big collection of animals that the museum received was from the menagerie of the stadtholder, William V of Orange, in The Hague. And at the same time that animals were being collected, art treasures were being collected and other things. It's really not particularly different from what Napoleon did later in Italy, bringing back all those magnificent art treasures to the Louvre. It started earlier with the animals.
They were loot.
They were loot. They were loot, and they were trophies of war. So when an animal was displayed back in Paris that had come from someplace else, it was something that the citizen could be proud of. So the elephants that were brought from The Hague were represented as essentially trophies of war. Likewise, from the bear pits in Bern, French soldiers confiscated those and brought them to Paris. So suddenly they found themselves in a new spot, the bears did, and it actually was not as wholesome a spot as they'd been in before.
In the book, you also point out that animals could be gifts, could be kind of state gifts to the people of France.
Yes, and that was an important source of animals, particularly after 1815. And my book is divided into two periods, and one from 1793 to 1815, and the second 1815 to 1838. And the big thing about 1815 is, in essence, the Battle of Waterloo and the routing of Napoleon, the final routing of him. And one would think that this might not be good for the museum, which was a state institution, but the defeat of Napoleon opened up the seas again. And so the freedom of the seas allowed naturalists to go abroad looking for animals, but it also allowed foreign rulers, particularly rulers of North Africa, to send animals to France again. They'd done it a little bit before 1815, but once they were free to send, once ships were able to cross the Mediterranean with impunity, then more animals started coming.
I'd like to think, Richard, that the wombats, kangaroos, black swans and emus at Malmaison, after the defeat of Napoleon, reached the zoo.
That seems almost to have been an accident. That expedition got through, and you probably have heard a lot about the Baudin expedition to Australia. It brought its animals and other treasures back in two shipments, one in 1803 and one in 1804. And in 1803, aboard ship were some black swans, which were destined for the museum. And Napoleon really had nothing to do with it, I would say. It was Josephine had the power herself. And she indicated to the Minister of the Interior, who was in charge of the museum's operations, that those black swans should be hers. And The kangaroo story is a little more complicated, but what essentially happened there was that the museum had been desperate for kangaroos. This, of course, was a spectacular new animal as far as Europe was concerned.
Indeed.
To see a kangaroo hopping about in one of the more pastoral places of the menagerie, that would have been wonderful. So actually, the way the museum got its first kangaroos was it went to London to buy a pair. And it's a complicated story, but it returned with the pair, and it happily had them in its collection. And then when the boat expedition's second ship came back, it had started with some 20 live kangaroos aboard, and when it arrived, there were only essentially two left, and they were of different species. Now, Josephine had her heart on having kangaroos at Malmaison, her estate, and when it turned out that those two kangaroos really wouldn't do, the museum essentially generously offered to her their own kangaroos, which they frankly did not want to do, but they felt it important to be on good terms with the people in power. Remember, the museum gets all its funding from the state. It's wholly dependent on the government, and so it's wholly dependent on the will and whims of those at the top.
Useful to keep them on side. I'm talking to Richard Burkhardt, former professor of history at the University of Illinois, about his wonderful new book, The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era. Richard, the humans. Who mattered at the zoo? Why does the zoo count in the history of science?
Let me first say that one of the things I try to do in my book is identify essentially the whole range of people who counted for the zoo's life and functioning. So this includes animal keepers whose names one never hears in histories of zoos, basically, but I essentially have documentation on all of the keepers for the period that I cover. And there are ship's captains who are bringing animals back and hoping to sell them to the government. There are generals who are sort of instructed to send animals from the places that they are temporarily in charge of. There are donors who, for dozens of different reasons, decide to give up an animal or provide an animal to the menagerie. But the strange thing is that people who perhaps should be most interested are kind of only secondarily interested, and those are the zoologists of the museum. And the zoologists of the museum are practicing a zoology that is very excited about new species, but is frankly happiest to work with specimens that are dead. And so when it comes to classifying things and ordering them, putting them, stuffing their skins and putting them in galleries, that's what the science of the time is doing. And the question is whether or not the menagerie can do something new for science beyond the provision of cadavers for the anatomists to work on.
Yes. I mean, one of the leading scientists involved was Georges Cuvier. Tell us about what he managed to do.
Well, Georges Cuvier was probably the greatest zoologist of the time. He is famous, somewhat notorious today, for being the greatest opponent of the evolutionary theory of his colleague Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. But for the benefit of the zoo, Georges didn't do much at all. He was intent on building up his comparative anatomy gallery. But what he did do, or help with, was get his younger brother appointed superintendent of the menagerie. And the younger brother, named Frédéric Cuvier, decided that in that capacity, he wanted to do something more than ride herd over the keepers and make sure the animals were getting properly fed. He wanted to be a scientist himself, and he thought that he could make the animals of the zoo scientific subjects. He thought that he could experiment on them, not in any invasive ways, but test their intelligence. He hoped that he could maybe breed species long enough over the course of generations to see whether or not they changed under the conditions of captivity. That was an idea that bore on the question of whether species change at all. He thought that instead of being a place where animals never exhibited any interesting scientifically interesting behavior at all. He could see things despite the cramped conditions under which they lived that could tell you how to make sense of animal instincts and animal intelligence. So that was his goal, and all the while he was playing second fiddle to the main interest of the museum, which was simply getting more specimens,
more corpses.
And more corpses. Yeah, they did send out naturalist voyagers as collectors after 1815. And one of the instructions to them at first was to bring back animals for the menagerie because that was new and exciting. That instruction was written by Frederick Cuvier. But then his older brother, Georges, who was the more important, later said, you really shouldn't waste time observing animals and collecting live ones and paying all the expense of transporting them back. Just collect dead ones for us. And once you send them back to us, we will turn them into scientific objects.
Put them in salt, smoke them, preserve them somehow or other, and bring them back. You tell a wonderful story that illustrates how hard it was to transport animals. You mentioned earlier that, you know, nearly all the kangaroos died in that shipment.
Yes.
But there's the wonderful story of the giraffe. It was bloody hard to transport a giraffe.
Absolutely. It was extremely difficult to get a giraffe that was originally captured in the south of Sudan, given to the viceroy of Egypt, Muhammad Ali, and then Muhammad Ali decides that this will be a diplomatic gift to the French. And for it to get to France, it had to be put on a boat in Alexandria. And for it to maybe survive or enjoy the trip,
yeah,
there was a hole cut in the deck so that while a giraffe was in the hold, it could stick its head up above and see what was going on. And then it arrives in Marseille, where it is going to have to spend the winter. It comes in November, I think, and there's a real fear that it would die if it went off in the cold, and so they decided to winter, and they decided to keep it in Marseille for the winter and observe it there. And then the spring, Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire, great zoologist, brings himself down from the museum in Paris, and he worries with the prefect of Marseille how to bring the giraffe to Paris, and they think about transporting it on rivers, but they eventually decide that the safest way will be to walk it all the way from Marseille to Paris, and that's essentially what they do.
Have you heard the story of the elephant walked across Austria? It was in the previous century. There was a gift from the King of Portugal to the Archduke of Austria, and this elephant was walked across Austria. And there are still across Austria pubs that are called Zum Elefant because they were places that the elephant rested on his long, long journey to Vienna. Zum Elefant.
I believe it's true in France as well. In Lyon, at least, there was a pub that was called La Giraffe
Perfect.
Instituted quickly after the giraffe passed through, and then the giraffe was memorialized in other things as well, in commemorative porcelain plates. It was
right.
Was it became this? It became a subject for pictures. It became an inspiration of women's fashions, clothing, and hairdos. It was a spectacular sensation once it arrived in Paris. After its 41-day trip, it comes to Paris, and one account says there might have been 100,000 people in Paris that tried to see it as it came in. I don't know that that's true, but there is an account from the museum that says 2 days after, when it was first opened for the public to see it at the Jardin des Plantes, at least 10,000 people came to see it. And the exciting thing about it for the Parisians was not just the spectacular giraffe, which they hadn't ever seen before. This 11-foot tall, beautiful, beautiful creature.
Richard, what did the zoos that followed, what did the zoos copy from Paris, and what did they change?
Well, the first thing was that Paris was a national zoo. And most of the zoos that followed were not. The zoo in London was not a public zoo at the beginning. It was a gathering of aristocrats and wealthy bourgeois who wanted to set up a zoological society of their own. They were inspired by Sir Stamford Raffles, the founder of Singapore, who had interacted with French naturalists even while he was out there, and who certainly wanted to have something to rival Paris, but it wasn't going to be a national zoo. And one advantage it had was certainly its more powerful colonial empire. And another advantage that zoos eventually developed once they became more fully public was that they charged admission. And the Paris Zoo did not. And the Paris Zoo relied wholly on the government, and that was fine when the government was giving enough funds for it. But they weren't able to bring in a spectacular new star animal and charge admission for it. In fact, they didn't want to, actually. Napoleon's brother, Lucien, in 1800 or so, tells the museum it really ought to charge for the elephants because he was tired of paying all these expenses for them. And they said, no, that would be beneath the dignity of our institution. We're a national institution. It's free to the public. Well, the later zoos didn't behave that way. They were able to profit from star animals, and they were able to bring in larger gates. And by the second half of the 19th century, the Paris Zoo simply couldn't compete with London and Berlin and other places. Melbourne got its zoo in 1862. Philadelphia got a zoo in 1872, maybe 1876. In any case, other zoos sprang up all around the world, and each sort of reflected the interest of the city where it was located. And each city really wanted to have a zoo as really a site of cultural excellence, a site of really of wealth and power, ability to command animals from around the world, either because of commercial strengths or political military strengths. It was a sign that a city was a leader in the world.
Richard, should we have zoos?
Well, that's that's a difficult question, and I think that the thing to say about that, of course, is that zoos have entirely different ideas of what they are up to than they did back in the time the menagerie in Paris started. Back then, the main argument for having a zoo was to domesticate more animals or to acclimatize animals for maybe their skins, but quite possibly to put them on the dinner table. Now, today, nobody's talking about a zoo animal for the dinner table. What zoos are talking about is conserving animals, preserving them from extinction. That was something that was not even considered at the beginning of the 19th century, but now it's provided as, I think, the primary rationale: preserve animals from extinction, teach people about the importance of habitat preservation. And I think, even though there are lots of things to say about zoos and the problems of having animals essentially as captives, which they are in zoos, we also have the dreadful problem in the world today of disrespect for nature, ignorance of what our greedy behavior does for the natural world, and the zoos are one place where the message of caring for nature is promoted. So I would on balance say that in the face of all the other things going on, a good zoo can really be of benefit. Fact is that hundreds of millions of people visit zoos every year. It's a staggering number. More people visit zoos than pay money to attend sports events. It's quite extraordinary. So if they can genuinely have an educative function, then yes, please, let's have zoos. And I have to say, when I visit zoos and talk to the people there who are caring for the animals, these are serious scientists, often veterinarians, who are who really do care for animals. And I think that image is something that is nice to try to communicate to the public.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to Richard Burkhardt Jr., who is the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois, about his new book, his beautiful new book, The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era, published by the University of Chicago Press.